I'm Tim Ventura from AmericanAntiGravity.com, and I'm here with Al Bielek of Philadelphia Experiment fame. Now, Al's worked on a variety of different systems over the years and has specialization in all sorts of different technologies, but he's the most well-known for both the Philadelphia Experiment and the Montauk Project, both of which were 1940s through 1980s era projects.
They both extended prior to that and after, but those are the basic time brackets.
Well, can you tell me a little bit about, I guess I should start with just an overview of the Philadelphia Experiment.
Okay. The Philadelphia Experiment, or that name, because in the ending phases, it was centered in the Philadelphia Navy Yard. The original work actually began at the Institute of Advanced Study in about 1933, and actually goes back about 2 years earlier than that, before the Institute even existed. The basic idea and the brainchild of this, which started it all, was Nikola Tesla. And he was kicking the ideas around with some friends at the University of Chicago about 1931. How can you make an object invisible? And there was a lot of discussion, but at that time nothing concrete happened. And 1932, Franklin Delano Roosevelt was elected the 32nd president, and he knew Tesla very well from World War I when he, Roosevelt, was under Secretary of the Navy, and Tesla did some government work then for the government in World War I. So Roosevelt becomes elected the 32nd president, and invites Tesla to Washington to have a little conversation, a tete-a-tete, you know, my old friend Nikola sort of thing. And, what are you up to now? And he already knew most of it. He wanted to get from Tesla's mouth. The intelligence wasn't good in those days, but it wasn't that bad either. And he told him what he was working on. And his ideas about invisibility and so forth, and Roosevelt sort of perked his ears up and said, well, because Roosevelt, of course, had a very heavy connection with the Navy. And he says, are you telling me that you might be able to make a complete naval warship invisible? I said, oh yes, this is the theory, and I said, I'm quite sure we can pull it off, it will take some years of work. So Roosevelt said, well, how would you like to be the director of this project? And I will see to it that you get some money, because at that time, the Office of Naval Research had a lot of money to burn, a lot of money to spend, and they weren't quite so much shut down as they were during World War, right after World War II. But they had the money available, and they funded Tesla, and they said one of the conditions would be that you move this operation to the Institute of Advanced Study in Princeton, New Jersey, and you'll be the director. Well, that's fine. He agreed to that, and they moved it there. And Tesla, of course, had many other things ongoing at that time, but he spent a certain amount of time at the Institute and also his other laboratory. He had a secret lab in New Jersey, very few people know about, as well as his alleged room. It was real in the Hotel New Yorker where he lived, but he also had a suite of rooms in the Waldorf Astoria and the two twin towers of the Waldorf were his labs. So he did a lot of work in a lot of locations on many different things. But he took to undertake this one and gave it a due attention and delegated other people to carry out his ideas and so on. Basically, it was conducted at the Institute from 1933 onward, when the Institute was actually formed with the four original founding members. He was not a staff member as such. He was the head of the project, but he had no folder arm, and I went to the Institute once and he archivist there, and I says, don't you have a file on Nikola Tesla? He says, well, we do, but there's nothing in it except this one telegram announcing his death and the funeral arrangements at the St. John's of Divine in New York, that's 43. But I said, he was not on staff, he was not paid by the Institute, therefore we did not keep a file on him. He just had that one folder. But I said, we do have a lot of people come in here as consultants, so we do not keep folders on it. I said, it happens all the time. But Tesla was in charge of the project, and it carried on in 1933 to 36. They had a first test in 36, which was pretty much a flop. They gave them some idea that they were maybe working in the right direction. And 1940, I got the first successful test using Sussel's equipment on a small Navy ship. I think it was a tender in the Brooklyn Navy Yard in 1940. And it was fully successful. The ship became invisible at dockside. According to reports I have heard of, I have not personally seen them in recent years. I was privy to that stuff once. And it was fully successful and gave them the idea that, well, now we need to do a full-scale test.
So the ship actually completely disappeared from view then?
Yes, there was even films recording it.
Oh, okay, okay. And were there any of the side effects that popped up later?
There was no one on board the ship when they did the test. They were concerned about possible side effects because of the large amounts of RF power being used. Tender wasn't as high as on the destroyer escort, which they used later. And they originally, this is getting out of the story, they also had projected a test on a battleship, and that's when Tesla pulled out. He says the power required for that is so high, he said you'll be killing sailors all over the place, and I won't be part of it.
Oh, definitely, definitely.
Yeah. So the 1940 test was successful. Then they decided to go for a later test, and this was the battleship test, which was scrubbed. It was, the equipment was fired up, and since Tesla had sabotaged it very neatly, nothing of much consequence happened. They lost some high-powered transmitting tubes and a few other things that immediately blew up. The field was never established around the ship, battleship, and no one was hurt because there wasn't any full-level radiation of power. So at that point, Tesla bowed out and says, the test is an obvious failure. I'm withdrawing. I have other things I need to do. But you have a good man here. I can take it over. Dr. John von Neumann, who was on the project and the Institute from the beginning. And I said, he can take this over. So von Neumann did. And von Neumann just got the notion he wanted to change the whole system. It was an analog system, so far as Tesla was concerned. Von Neumann changed it to a pulse mode. You might call it a digital system. It was pulse mode transmission he wanted to use. He said you get more power in the pulse rather than straight analog. He kept the basic format of frequencies were involved, what they were interacting with, how they were trying to create the field of visibility. In a nutshell, what they were doing was creating a field of invisibility by manipulating space-time and the gravity field, producing a, what we could best call a electromagnetic gravitic warp around the ship, which would warp light so that light would pass around the ship through this warp field, and all you would see would be what was the back of the ship. Background scenery, background of other ships, of the shoreline, whatever, would be visible. And if that is visible, and you can't get any reflection of energy, radar or otherwise, off of the ship itself, then the ship is invisible. And of course, optically, it was also invisible. You couldn't see it. All you could see this wavering field while it was building up, and then eventually it became completely gone. And so far as the theory was concerned, and so far as the basic test was concerned, the system worked. And they had the first full-blown test, actually, in July of 43, July 22nd, if I remember the date correctly. And that was aboard a destroyer escort type ship. And it was held in Down Harbor. It was not in the Navy Yard itself. All of the work was done in the Navy Yard. It took theoretical work continued on at the Institute, but the generation of hardware, ordering of hardware, outfitting the ship took place in the Navy Yard. That's the Philadelphia Navy Yard. And then when the equipment was ready and the ship was ready, they took it down a stream about 6 miles where there was, in those days, far less visibility from the shore of anything they were doing. I was almost uninhabited then. I'm talking about now, but at that time. And they conducted the, three tests down river. The first one, July 22nd, was fully successful. The ship became invisible. They had a small carrier there with the man who was in charge, a naval officer in charge of the whole project. And Von Neumann and all the other scientists who wanted to witness it directly were on board the carrier deck. I mean, orders were given from the carrier, and the people who carried out those orders was Duncan and myself, my half-brother Duncan Cameron and myself, then I was known as Ed Cameron. And we, at that point, when we were doing the test, we had been elevated to the rank of captain in the Navy, U.S. Navy. And we were there because we were both trained physicists. We both had PhDs in physics. And they wanted, basically, scientist types there to run the equipment because they said, if something goes wrong, you're responsible as to what happens next. Now, you try to repair the equipment, you shut it down, just what you do, and it's going to have to be your decision if something goes wrong as to what to do. We want people there who know the whole theory and know everything that's involved with the systems. That's why they chose us. And first test, we ran the equipment, we turned it on by radio command. And July 22nd, everything went very smoothly. There's no problems. The visibility field was working. They couldn't finally see the ship at all. And the Navy liked the results, but they said there was just one problem here. We want invisibility to sight. We do not want radar invisibility. Well, now that changed. Sorry, turn that around. We want primarily radar invisibility. We do not want physical invisibility. It required a little bit more power to get full physical optical invisibility. We says we want radar invisibility because that is what we're fighting against the German Navy and their radar systems. But we do not want total invisibility because in a convoy at night, we've got to be able to see where the ships are. And we don't have any radio silence. They have to be able to see them optically and be able to signal to them so they don't hit each other.
Sure,
and
sure.
Full radar invisibility, they'd be ramming each other in a tightly knit convoy.
Well, this test actually did have side effects, though, right? You actually.
I'm sorry?
Well, you know, one of the things, when you initially described this interview, I've heard this for the first time in 1996 when you were speaking on the Art Bell Show.
Yep.
And I guess in a way to show how far things have come since then, when I first heard this, I thought, you know, this technology is so incredible. I have no way to understand how it might work.
Yep.
And strangely enough, you know, over the years and having done the research that I've been able to do, I can't explain it all, and I don't have all of the details, but I'm finding more and more evidence for every single aspect of the Philadelphia effect that you described.
Yes.
You know, the rotating magnetic fields that you described as part of the Eldritch.
Rotating electromagnetic fields. There's two fields, a magnetic field, and inside of that, an RF or electric field, which was separately generated. They ran at different rates of rotation. It was very specific rates of rotation because we were interacting with the Earth's gravity field. And it required the interaction of three fields, gravity, electric, and magnetic, to warp space-time enough to create the effect of invisibility. You couldn't do it with pure... You can do it under certain circumstances with a pure magnetic field. It has been replicated in the laboratory using very high-powered pulsed magnetic fields on a model ship. It will become invisible and slowly come back to visibility, but you can't maintain it very long that way. And, of course, if you want a ship to go to sea and maintain these fields whenever they want to turn them on, you have to have complete control over the fields that are surrounding that ship. And I think Tesla was a man, basically, who came up with the concepts. He came up with so many different ones, which were ignored for decades. But he came up with the concept that the electromagnetic and gravity fields all interact and interact with a fourth field, which is time. And if you interact with time, you can produce a time field displacement, shifted slightly, without moving, attempting to move the ship through time, but just put a displacement factor in there of the right magnitude, and the ship will drop out of sight. It will not leave physically, it just drops out of sight, because you're warping the electromagnetic fields and the light fields connected with it. It works, it did work, but they had a problem they didn't recognize at that time. They partially recognized it. Tesla warned them against it and said, you play around with electromagnetic fields of this power, you don't know what you're going to do with the ship's personnel. Well, that proved, of course, to be the case. The guys who were stationed on deck as direct observers while the fields were operating went insane. Well, at least the Navy said they did. I'm not so sure that they were insane, but they were very seriously disturbed neurologically.
Sure, sure, that makes sense.
Yeah, and of course they didn't understand at that time that that kind of power, the we're talking about megawatts of RF power and very powerful rotating magnetic fields. You can understand that the human nervous system is susceptible to that sort of thing. If you get enough power, it's going to be seriously susceptible. And literally, the guys, someone disappeared right off the deck of the ship and were never seen again. Nobody knows where they went. Those who were on deck became partially invisible themselves, but inside the field, it didn't affect them that much because the field was designed to produce the effect of invisibility around the ship, but outside of the, shall we say, the perimeter of the ship. It was like a doorknob with a big hole. The ship was in the hole. The doorknob represents the electromagnetic fields which were being generated.
Oh, okay.
Now, in the initial considerations of how to produce this effect, there was a lot of discussion. And Tesla originally wanted to do it a different way. He wanted to produce a field which could be called an oblate spheroid, which was a completely enclosed field. What was finally adopted was a toroidal field, which was not closed, but open. Open in the center, of course, that's where the ship would be. And that was a fatal flaw. And I'll explain why in a little bit. But that was easier to do. It was a consideration at the time, and since the war was on, they were concerned about time and how soon could we get a working system going and be able to replicate it and put it on other ships.
Sure.
Very natural and normal considerations, but they did not really understand the nature of the beast that they were dealing with. And little did they understand or have any concept of the fact that the continuation of the research at Montauk in the 70s and the 80s with alien help was deliberately designed by the alien groups influencing the design work at Montauk to create a working wormhole. Little did they understand what it was that aliens were asking for as compensation for their efforts of helping us. They wanted control of the station for, quote, their own agenda, unquote, periodically, which agenda was never explained, of course, to the U.S. government personnel involved. It's U.S. government and our military kept a tight surveillance on this project, and there were a lot of people in and out of Montauk. There was a permanent staff. There was also the alien groups there who were helping out technologically, and they were telling us what had to be built, how to design it, and everything. We had all those outside contractors. ITT Corporation was a prime contractor at that time, and they were broken up later because of certain other factors won't go into it. But the basic problem was that with the open doorknob-type field, you would create the rotating field all right, but you left the hole in the center open where the ship was, and this type of structure was susceptible to being manipulated by another group, other energy fields, from another time. We had not the slightest concept of this at that time. But what was happening was, in a period of time around 1883, they were getting ready for their alien groups, were getting ready for their little ploy, in which, as we found out much later, the final date for our test, which was handed down from the CNO at that time, the Chief of Naval Operations, to Dr. Van Neumann, we want the system modified, but you have to finish these tests by 12 August 43 or forget it. Well, whoever gave that order, and then of course it came through the normal Navy channels, knew Van Neumann well enough to know that he would take every last minute up to the last minute of the last day, getting the equipment ready to his satisfaction, and the test had to be put off on the 12th of August, otherwise the whole thing would be canceled. Now, the 12th of August proved to be an extremely critical date. It seems that other research, which is conducted since, what the alien groups knew all about this, because they knew far more about Earth's, how should we call it, their electromagnetic fields, their physical setup, the other realities, and the way all of this interacts. They knew that we had no knowledge of the fact that Earth has its own biofields and rhythms. The human body has three biofields and a set of rhythms, which, of course, are well known. the human element aspect was known, but the fact that the body of Earth, which in a certain sense has a certain life, creates its own biorhythms and its own fields. It's four biorhythms that interact. And I passed this information on to, to Preston Nichols after this project was done. I met Preston again back in 1993. We spent a lot of time together discussing the whole business, the potential interactions here. And I said, look, my information, Earth has four biofields, and they interact once every 20 years for about half a day where they peak out. They're additive. That happens to be on the 12th of August, 1943, 63, 83, 2003, whatever. Every 20 years, plus or minus half a day, with corrections for the Julian calendar, which is not absolutely accurate. But the Earth is susceptible, and the fields are susceptible, on those dates, to manipulation. Now, this will know this whole answer. That was the alien groups running and interconnected with Montauk. Now, Montauk was not run by aliens, it was run by humans. But the interlocking information, the interlocking directives, the interlocking engineering through Jack Pruitt, who was a station master, and others above him, they were willing to allow the aliens their own agenda periodically, and it turned out that one of the dates they wanted the agenda to be operative was on 12 August 1983. And the station was normally only used two or three times a week for a couple of hours, and all the power was involved there was enormous, so they didn't turn it on very often. They already had all the animals flee off of eastern Long Island and had all kinds of strange weather phenomena. And they're dealing with 500 megawatts and up or of transmission. Enormous amounts of power. They had the station online operational for a couple of days prior to the 12th of August, which was a most unusual maneuver, because they wanted it, so it was done. And we, meaning the humans at that time, had not the slightest cognition of what it was they were doing. And what they were doing, as we found out in the 90s by going back and mentally examining all of the evidence and looking in terms of what we knew of the actual operation of the station out of the Philadelphia experiment, what they were doing was producing a lockup between the two systems. A lockup which spanned a 40-year time span, 12 August 43 to 12 August 83, or a possible node point 20 years in between, which didn't count in this case. But they were producing a huge rift in space-time, and it was done very deliberately by the aliens for their own benefit. Their benefit meaning that they wanted a large fleet of ships to come through into our reality from elsewhere, which was not aimed at us. They were merely using us as a way station to get their ships and fleet through to continue a war with somebody else. I don't even know who it was. I don't know if anybody knew who it was. But there was a fact of that two systems locking up produced the effect whereby in the 12 August test, yes, producing visibility, but then suddenly everything went haywire and the ship disappeared into space-time and turned up in a, you could call it an alternate reality. It was a condition where it was lost in hyperspace, which of course mathematically is a term outlining a mathematical symbology, a mathematical concept of a strange state of space-time which does not normally exist, which can only be described in mathematical terms. But it is creatable, and what happened is it created it artificially. The Eldridge literally left its location in the bay where it was being tested, became invisible, then blinked out altogether, disappeared, and the water line disappeared, and the ship was gone. Everybody knew the ship was gone. They couldn't communicate with it, nothing. It was gone for approximately 4 hours of time at a Navy yard or in a downriver, or it finally returned, but it was again got into hyperspace because of the interaction of these two systems.
Well, Al, one thing that I'd like to ask is, there are a lot of inventors out there listening to this, and they're probably thinking to themselves, you know, on a small scale, can I touch any of these fields? Is this something I can maybe not full hyperspace, but even different aspects of this, like the gelification of metals from the Hutchison effect, or lots of different things that tie into not only the rotating magnetic fields, but also it sounds like Bearden's quantum potentials might be involved to some degree. And
yes, well, quantum physics came out of this work, and von Neumann is given the credit for the way he developed quantum physics back in the days of the late 40s. There's further research was done on the project eventually to solve the problems, but yes, there's many things involved here, quantum physics, newer concepts of physics that did not exist in the textbooks. See, at the Institute of Advanced Study, they're doing all the advanced research, and they had all the advanced scientists there working on this sort of stuff. They were creating concepts. They were creating new mathematical systems. They were creating entirely new ideas of what our physical reality really is.
Oh, sure, sure. Well,
and of course, one of the things which eventually turned up, and of course this was known by the ancients, but was not known by our scientists and physicists of that era, that actually we are a multiple reality universe, and actually multiple reality groupings, if you will, of planet Earth. Planet Earth itself has seven realities, what we call planet Earth, the whole total mesh, the whole total concept. There are seven orphan realities, and they can be mathematically defined. And this is one of the things that came out of the research after the war, and it was some of von Neumann's work, and plus a lot of others, and some of it came out of ancient texts, and some of it came out of pure research. But there are many aspects involved with reality, which most people have no concept. There's not a word or a brush given to this in any current textbook. And they keep it well hidden that way. Those who dig can find the information, but you have to dig and know where to dig.
Well, in terms of replicating, you know, I doubt that anyone has the turboelectric generators to be able to create their own Philadelphia experiment, but on a small scale, do you think that there are some experiments that people could do to move closer to being able to understand this, at least experimentally?
Yes. There was a laboratory replication of the experiment by the means of very high-powered pulse magnetic fields. The story of this, there's a full paper was issued in the Cecil Society meeting in 1994 by the Corum brothers. They did this in the lab. What they did was they said we couldn't afford the equipment to build something to sustain a high-powered magnetic field of the intensity we wanted. So what they did was they got some of these energy discharge capacitors, charged them up in a normal manner with normal power supplies, and then discharged these huge capacitors or the backs of them into a system of coils wrapped around a model ship, and then get back a distance from the test so it wouldn't be bathed in too much strong magnetic or electromagnetic fields itself, and try to photograph it. Well, they said they were able to create invisibility of the high pulse run through these coils from a discharging bank of capacitors would create a left magnetic field so that the model ship became invisible, bang, just flipped into invisibility, and then slowly came back into the visible range. So they were able to prove in the lab that you could do this. Their attempt was not to replicate the whole system, but can you prove theoretically that this is possible? And they did. And the paper was issued and is available, and it is referenced. It's they're on the website if you know where to look, and I don't know the exact name now on their website, but it's on my CD. The reference to their paper and some of the text. They gave me permission when we made up the original CD to quote from their text, but not the whole thing. It's just we want to sell copies of this ourselves. So, but it is referenced in the CD, the work that the Corum brothers did. They did it at Mattel Memorial at the time when they did this. It was in, I believe, the 70s, or maybe it was in the early 80s. That's in the paper, the exact date and the time procedures. But they proved in the lab that you could do this with a very high-powered pulse magnetic field.
Oh, I've heard that they also did some research into lifters and anti-gravity for NASA also.
They may have. I'm not aware of
it. I think that was the 2002-2003 era. NASA actually put some funding forward, if I remember right, or Congress did, and it went to ISR. And I think it was James Corum, if I remember right.
Yeah, only one of the Corum brothers is alive now. One of them passed on, the others continuing the theoretical work, and they left Patel there. I think he's I talk with the one who's still alive. He said, "Oh, in, I believe Kentucky is working with a computer research group," and he says this part of his work in the past, he doesn't talk much about there at this institute he's working at because he says it's not accepted science there. It's still not accepted science in terms of the textbook, and he has to keep the textbook attitude and to continue his work that he's doing. He's working with computer systems, advanced computer systems. What he's doing, I have no idea, but that was what he told me.
Oh, sure, sure.
And, but he says, yeah, the paper is still published and is available on the website. He did not make any real mention of what further work he may have done. I've been out of touch with him about 5 years.
Well, do you know what it was about the coils? It's interesting to hear that they could actually create invisibility. I was surprised that the effect would even work to that degree. But they could create the invisibility just using a pulsed coil apparatus. Do you know if there was a special configuration of the coils? Or?
I do not know. He said they would wrap coils around the model ship. Now, he gave me no further description than that. So I have no further information whether it's a special form of the coil or special number of turns or just random. I don't know. I would doubt that it was random. They must have had some basis for selecting a particular design, probably related to Ampere turns and how many turns are produced, how much magnetic field, and so forth. And that's all calculable by a normal electrical science. But the important point was that two points. One, they did get the effect. Number two, they couldn't put it on film. They couldn't make a movie film of it. He said the fields are so powerful they wiped out the emulsion.
Oh, okay.
In the film. I think they also tried, I don't know, somebody else tried with a tape recorder or a magnetic recording system of some kind that wiped that out too. More likely would wipe out the magnetic before the optical system, but I know some other people who tried to do the same thing, they wiped out everything. You had to get far enough back, and which means you'd have to use a telephoto lens and get maybe a quarter of a mile back if you're out in the open or in a large lab building. You'd have to be far enough back so the magnetic fields would not create a massive interference.
Sure.
Because they were pulsing enormous amounts of power, and the pulse magnetic field was overriding the normal field by many times, probably hundreds of times of field intensity, and affects things in a way you don't normally understand. Some research in the last 5 years has shown that very high power pulse magnetic fields or electromagnetic fields have reactions in areas which were never suspected. You can produce time modulation effects, you can produce all kinds of other effects because you start dropping out of the domain or expanding out of the domain that you are working in and overriding into other domains. And if you consider the fact that we have shall we say, a nested reality of seven parallel realities, we don't know what we're doing to them. I don't know if anybody's ever sat down mathematically and tried to calculate this as to what the effects might be on other realities and why the other ships slipped out of our reality into hyperspace, which means possibly could be interpreted, and I'm saying this as a theoretical analysis, but could possibly be interpreted as it went into another reality rather than just into hyperspace, but where does one end and the other begin? There's a lot of research that needs yet to be done, possibly has been done on the QT in terms of government research, because I know some of the government research work has been very advanced. I mean, they've replicated all of the alien anti-gravity drives, we've replicated other things. Our fiber optic systems were taken off of one of the crashed UFOs, the one in 1947 in New Mexico, the Roswell crash, as they called it. A lot of things were taken off of that craft, and of course, the government denies it. And the man who published on this wrote a book on the subject, broke all of his agreements on security, gave an open lecture in 1997 at Roswell, New Mexico. I met him there, and he says, "I've broken all of my security agreements. I'm telling you this," he says, "I think that the public has a right to know." See, the stuff we took off that craft was my job to put this into the mainstream of industrial technology and get it in a way where they would never know where it came from, but at the same time, they would have access to it and further the development, which is what has happened.
Well, the transistor might possibly be an example where it just kind of showed up at Bell Labs around 47, if I remember correctly.
But prior to that, there was T. Henry Morey out of Salt Lake City that had an amorphous type transistor using a variety of gallium arsenide, I believe. He had some very high-frequency transistors working back in the 20s. He took out a patent for a transistor radio in 1929, which he tried to, and Oaks refused to accept it because the device, quote, had no heaters, unquote. In other words, they were used to vacuum tubes and could not accept the concept of an amplifying crystalline device.
Oh, sure, sure.
Of course, it's not well known. I mean, what are all our computers? They're all the same basic technology. But at that time, it was a completely unknown technology, and the patent office wouldn't accept it.
Well, you know, I'm sorry.
You never got good credit for it, but it has been published. I've seen the published data on it, and there was a book which T. Henry Morey used to circulate himself on the transistor and the old transistor radio, which didn't even need a battery to run. I don't know how it worked, but it was a very strange device. And then he developed higher power devices in which he was extracting energy from the atmosphere. Well, that's what he said, but he was extracting energy from something, which he understood. And he'd go out in the desert with a van and turn on his equipment. He could develop between 25 and 50 kilowatts of power from an antenna picking up who knows what. He knew, but he never made it very explicit as to what it was he was picking up or how the system really worked, because his very amplifying tubes that he was using, which had a strange internal structure, were built in Germany because you couldn't get them built here in the U.S. and expect to maintain secrecy. And his one working system was eventually destroyed, and his son took over, and after T. Henry died, his son was trying to get the system reinvented, if you will, replicated, and went around for years. I heard one of his lectures and said, we can replicate the whole system, about $50,000 or some such figure, but nobody apparently bid on it. And we do not know how much interference came from where, whether it was government interference or it was interference from perhaps his own church connections or who it was. But they were out to get him, and they finally did.
Well,
he was shot in his lab.
In addition to Morey, though, one of the things that I found out, in fact, this just happened, and it'd be interesting to hear your opinion on it. I interviewed a gentleman named Ted Gagnon a few weeks ago.
What was his name?
His name is Ted Gagnon.
I've heard of him.
He works with quantum potential envelopes, and it was a big learning experience for me. And I've heard of these for years with relation to Tom Bearden's writings, but I've never understood what Bearden was talking about. And Gagnon, actually, he's actually been building devices. I'm sorry?
The name is Gagnon?
Yeah, Gagnon. I believe it's G-A-G-N-O-N. And
I've heard of it somewhere.
Yeah, I was surprised that he came out of kind of the alternative medical community, working with devices for health and wellness, but the principles that he's developed, the theory behind it, actually lets him manipulate matter in a very unique way. And he felt that if you scaled up this device, which worked on essentially its combining maybe 10 to 20 frequencies in combination with each other, some of them harmonic, some of them possibly not, apparently each atom or each element has different sets of frequencies associated with it. And by using these frequencies, he felt that on a large scale, with enough power, you could replicate the Hutchison effect. And as you know, the Hutchison effect has many of the same effects that the Philadelphia experiment had.
He got it by accident, and a sort of random combination of things, which happened to just fall in the right place. And Hutchison did record it, and it's well known in those in the circles that have examined his work. But trying to replicate it on a controllable basis has been the goal of quite a few for some years. Fully controllable, I don't know if they've ever achieved.
Yeah, that's something that I've wondered about also. And the breakthrough for Gagnon's research, I guess, is that he has a theoretical model to predict these frequencies. And I don't fully understand it, but hopefully that might give us an element of control over many of the effects that were...
Is it perhaps tied into the atomic chart, the atomic table, in the sense that there are frequencies which could probably be enumerated by atomic number and a certain structure and so forth. I understand what he's trying to say or do, but I don't know if anybody's really gotten a good handle on it.
Sure, sure. I think it is something along those lines, and not only that, but also it may involve valence electrons, just, you know, changing the orbitals, and that way changing the footprint, you know, of each atom. So that the idea being, though, at least as a rough guess, that you could take an element like aluminum, you know, with an I-beam like Hutchison had, and for a very brief period of time, while these fields are running, this aluminum I-beam might behave as if it was mercury and melt and you know, flow all over the place. And when it leaves the perimeter of the field or when the field is turned off, it would re-solidify in its new shape with the added difference of not only is it physically changed, but its molecular structure would be frozen in a kind of a quasi-state. The other thing he'd mentioned that was surprising to me was he felt like, well, one of the aspects was there's constructive and destructive combinations of fields so that you could actually take aluminum and make it stronger. And I guess that same principle works very generally in the health aspects of this.
Yeah, there's many things in terms of health and the human body which we don't understand, whether it be medics or whether it be alternative healing people. We don't fully understand about the human body and the way it works and the fact that it is a conglomerate of many fields, electric, magnetic, and otherwise. Where if you know how to access them properly, you can stimulate the body into rebuilding itself into doing things which maybe people never thought it could do. And in terms of the healing arts, yes, very definitely. The human body is, theoretically speaking, is capable of healing itself of anything. I'm saying theoretically. In terms of the design structure of the body, it was designed to withstand practically anything and rebuild itself, heal itself, unless it was something that outright destroyed the whole body in very short order, which would be completely destructive. But normally, the body can heal itself of certain ills and ailments and so forth, and many of our ills and ailments today are artificially generated anyway. But, yeah, if we understood more, and apparently some few people have found understanding, of how the body works and all of the electromagnetic and other frequencies that are involved and the resonances and so on, we could probably do a job of healing the body quite rapidly rather than taking months or years, but nevertheless heal it. And we don't understand all of the mechanisms involved in the human body. There's much more than a physical body. That's the problem. Most physical scientists don't want to acknowledge the electromagnetic aspects, the spiritual aspects, the other body forms which are there other than the physical. In other words, the emotional body, so-called, the mental body, the magnetic shell body, which, and of course the matrix blueprint for each human body, which is what causes the body to grow up as the child grows to a particular final form, is all there in the first place. We don't really understand it.
Yeah, definitely. But, you know, the thing that surprised me was just, you know, once again, it's the elements of the Philadelphia experiment, which was such an amazingly different experience, I guess, when you'd first talked about it on air. You know, these components of it are becoming more and more part of conventional science. For instance,
as time goes on, that's true.
Yeah, they have now, you know, within standard quantum mechanics theory, they've now teleported, I think it was an atom, across a lab.
Yes, I've heard of that.
Yeah, you know, so, I mean, these things that were, you know, once upon a time, it was people looking at this going, well, it's a nice story, but it's almost a fairy tale, and we're able to look back at this now, and, you know, it's 2004, it's not that much.
It's not a fairy tale anymore.
Yeah, and it is. It's reality. This is a reality. And we have teleportation, not full objects yet, but, you know, the idea is there for it.
Well, we do have full object teleportation, but it's in the restricted formats. Montauk created a wormhole tunnel which would transmit an object, a person, a truck, whatever you wanted, to wherever there was another. Well, actually, in terms of Montauk, you didn't have to have another Stargate. It wasn't a Stargate operation. Transmitted across the universe, as long as you had the coordinates and knew where you were going to set up the field which would recreate the object when it got to the other end. And then turn the phasing around so that you could bring the thing or the person back. The Stargates, I don't know how many of your listeners are into the Stargate phenomenon. If you go back to the original movie Stargate, that is absolutely correct. 100% correct. Stargates do exist, our government has them. I can't give you any further information on that, but they have used them. And at one time, they were apparently fairly common on Earth, and they're still used elsewhere.
Well,
I can't go into more than that.
To interject something I'd read, actually, and I've always found this interesting. And again, it was theory, and it almost seemed like a fairy tale until they started working with paired electron spins, and they had found. This is actually quantum computer encryption. They're going to be using this for encryption schemes. They trust it that much, and it's well within standard quantum physics. The idea is that you have two particles with the same spin, preferably electrons, because of less interference from mass and other factors. And apparently, when these two particles are created in a unique way, I guess, the spins are paired. And what they found is that by taking one and changing it, that change is instantly applied to the other. And I don't fully understand it, but the thing that was unique about that is in the test they've done with this, the change is instantaneous, and it seems to not be affected by time in any way. So that you could take one of these particles and move it to a distant alien planet, and if you change the other on Earth, you would instantly change the one on the other planet. So.
Yeah.
It allows, in one sense, faster light communications, but it also really...
Well, faster than light, I did right there, the faster than light communications were originally postulated and developed by Tesla, and Mark Bell perfected the system over 20 years ago for the so-called longitudinal wave of Tesla. I have a videotape going into all of this and showing in the lab how it works. And Mr. Eric Diller did this about 1986-87 in the lab, and the videotape is not well known, but he showed the difference between standard transverse waves as opposed to normal electromagnetic wave transmission and theory as we know it today, and the longitudinal wave of Tesla, which travels instantaneously across the universe. Violates everything that Einstein ever said and so forth, but they've been using it. And this type of transmission, the transverse wave, engages a lot of possibilities which are fascinating as well as actually exist in a practical manner. Combined thought matter is transverse waves because the mind can transmit to another mind anywhere if you are capable of the telepathic linking, but it is an instantaneous form of transmission, and Marbell has long since found out how to convert that into, so let us say, hard science, into a transverse wave transmitter receiver system. Just call your cell phone.
Well, one of the interesting questions, I guess, more philosophy at this point than anything else, is one of the complaints about Star Trek, and I think they even addressed this in the movie, was that in the Star Trek universe, their fictional universe, the transporter works by breaking the person down and rebuilding them out of different atoms.
Yeah, that was the theory in the Star Trek, yes.
Yeah, and one of the things with wormholes that would be different is a wormhole should actually be transmitting the actual atoms, as opposed to...
That is true. That is correct.
And in Star Trek, they never really addressed the fact that in a very real sense, they were, every time the transporter fired, they were killing someone and...
Putting them back together.
Yeah, and putting them back together somewhere else. But the actual materials the person was composed of disappeared, presumably into the they probably had a storage compartment filled with lead or something that, people turned into.
Yeah, that's true. The Star Trek concept... was an interesting concept in theory, but it's not the way it works. The true Stargate system or the Montauk type of operation, there is no breaking down and reconstruction. The object's energy field, whatever it is transmitted whole of itself as it is, and the only thing that can go wrong is if your transmission system, whether it's a Stargate or whether it's a wormhole or whatever you want to call it, if that thing broke down before the object got to the other end, yes, it could be dissipated into infinite space and would never show up. But as long as the transmission medium remains intact, that object will come out at the other end completely intact the way it was. And the Stargate movie showed that rather correctly. A lot of people dispute this because it's Stargate, but all I will say is I have knowledge of what has happened in terms of the recapture of Stargates in their current use, and the fact that they have been used and they can be used quite literally. As long as you have the coordinates, you can use it across the universe. There's no limitation.
You know, one of the differences, at least as a comparison, you know, and keeping in mind that even nanotechnology, you know, using a large computer with nanoscale manipulators could do the Star Trek transporter probably in the next 100 to 200 years. So I think that the technology is coming one way or another, but it's interesting that the Star Trek style or the nanotech style transporter is almost like a picture where it takes a snapshot of what something looks like and reassembles it, whereas the wormhole-based approach would almost be closer to a hologram, where it's capturing the wavefront, and that wavefront would be kind of the quantum coherence or the quantum potential for the entire organism, including their thoughts and whatever electrical activity was going on in the mind, and if it goes with people, their soul, and it would take the entire thing and move it, as opposed to just a cheap snapshot.
Sure, but one of the things in the Stargate type system, or any wormhole type system, you've got to transport not only the body, that all the subtle fields and energies, the soul, if you want to put it that way, of that person along with it. You can't leave part of it behind. The physical body is much more than just a collection of atoms and tissues and living tissue and so forth. Their energy field is connected with the human body, which must go with it, or you kill the body. And it's a very unique transport mechanism. I don't know, I don't think today we could possibly replicate it even theoretically, much less in terms of actual hardware to build it. The wormhole, as was originally developed at Montauk, got a lot of alien help. And those guys, some of them were very, very knowledgeable. Those who came from outside, from older civilizations, and had the knowledge. And they were transferring it to us in their own language and knew how we could do it, as long as we were told how to do it, and given the proper guidance, which we were. But those types of technologies are very, very advanced, and it took other minds. We can replicate it eventually, but who created some of these systems in the first place? Who knows? But they worked.
Well, it would be interesting to see, and I don't know, maybe this is something that only the government could do, but I'd almost wondered if there was a way to flag down a UFO, for lack of a better word, I always thought it would be neat. What if you could put a sign on your house that said ET land here? And while I doubt that would probably do much, with some of these technologies, do you think there might be a signature for actually calling some of these other beings?
When you say a signature, exactly what you mean?
Well, one of the things that I'd wondered about, and I, looking back in hindsight, I kind of doubt it, but when I was running the lifters every day, there was a period of a few months where I just started building up in my experiments, and I was escalating power levels and escalating the size and output of these devices. And, you know, there were a couple really interesting UFO reports that were right here in the Seattle area. And I'd always wondered. I thought, well, you know, it's like, for instance, we used a nuclear bomb for the first time in the 1940s, and shortly thereafter, UFO reports start pouring in, and the thought had been, are there different types of electromagnetic signatures that they would pick up? And, like, a nuclear bomb would make sense, because if it's not a star, you know, there aren't many situations in the universe where nuclear events happen, so.
No, they don't, as you say, other than star, they don't happen by themselves. There's too much complexity involved with the nuclear device and special combinations of materials, and on and on and on. They don't have a reaction. That's what you're saying, and I agree 100%. The nuclear device has to be designed and created, and very carefully designed and created to know what it's going to do. Those are not events that are random, happen by accident.
Yeah, well, not only that, but it's possible, judging by how sensitive cell phones are and modern communications, I'd always wondered if, something like the Philadelphia experiment, if an inventor was able to work with something like that, maybe not the exact same technology, but something similar, I'd always wondered, what if E.T. showed up and said, hey, please stop, you're messing with our phone system,
Yeah.
I mean, presumably they're using some type of FTL communications thing, and our first efforts would almost be, like if you look at electromagnetic motors from 1950s era appliances, they cause horrific interference with modern day communications technology because, they weren't really shielded, they used a lot of power, they used metal cases, so whatever fields you have going on just get amplified. And, not to say that they were better or worse, but that compared to the more sensitive modern equipment, sometimes I wonder if, you have SETI broadcasting messages out there into the galaxy, but it may be in a way that's almost secondary. Those nuclear bombs.
They were using basically electromagnetic radiation, not standard electromagnetics, which limits the speed of light, and also the attenuation factor of an electromagnetic wave is such that they're not going to get very far. That's using a transverse wave. And if you use longitudinal waves, all that Tesla, you can get across the universe. Today, they know the difference. Tesla knew the difference, but no one wanted to listen to him at that time.
Oh, definitely. I mean, Tesla was so, in so many ways, he was so far out there, but I think for the next few hundred years.
Yeah, he was a genius in his own right, and we respect him. Some people respected that, and others did not. And those who respected it just quite literally in some instances, so he stole them blind. But then again, he was not a fool. He had over 400 patents at the time of his alleged death. I say alleged because there's a lot of evidence that he didn't die in 43. But in any case, of over 400 patents, which were all displayed at the University of Texas Museum at the University, I'm not sure which one, but it's in Belgrade, Yugoslavia. They built the Tesla Museum and Library and all of that after World War II was over. They seized everything in his apartments and labs in New York in 43 and put it in compounded storage until the war was over. Because in his will, he said he wanted everything transferred to his homeland. His homeland was Serbia, but it was absorbed by Yugoslavia after World War II, so they built the museum in Yugoslavia, in Belgrade. But they have published on all of his patents. They published everything he did. Apparently the museum there is still translating and still publishing some of his newer stuff. I am not in touch with them, but I know they put a lot out. I've seen some of the republished patents. And he's had over 400 of them, and he had some incredible stuff. And he was very, very advanced in his thinking, his mathematics. And for a man who never had a formal degree, he had honorary doctorates given to him afterwards, even while he's alive. But, for a man who never completed even the first year of college, the things he has done, he was an absolute genius. There's no question. He was self-trained, self-taught, possibly, because there's rumors about where he came from, that he possibly brought all the knowledge with him from wherever he came from.
Oh, sure. You have to
also, there's another interesting side to the issue here, which we don't know much about. He had a brother he was very fond of, and the brother died at the age of 10 from a horse accident. And so it was said that Tesla never totally recovered from that in terms of the emotional aspect. And maybe that influenced his wanting to leave his home area and come to the U.S. I won't go into his early history, but he had quite an interesting early history. He finally connected with people who believed him and had some money. One of them fleeced him thoroughly, but the other one never did. But those are all side issues. Where did Tesla get his knowledge? Nobody knows. except Mr. Tesla, wherever he is now.
Yeah, yeah, and it was, he had a completely unique view, and even with the knowledge that we have now, you know, looking back, it's how would someone find that information? It's quite remarkable.
He had knowledge which we're only beginning to uncover today, and he made it work. When he, anything he wanted to do or achieve, he made it work. Even that field systems to shield a city from attack, and he was, I don't know if he considered nuclear attack, but during World War II he was trying to get the British and the Canadians to accept these shielding electromagnetic, or whatever they really were, shielding systems which would keep the bombs out of England or wherever. They didn't believe him. They didn't believe it could work. But well, since then, they found out they knew what he was talking about.
Now
a lot of developments and a lot of systems which, while they were theoretical concepts, his theoretical concepts usually didn't work the first time he built them.
Yeah, I'm sorry to interrupt. We're out of time for today, but I'd definitely like to invite you back for the future. This has been
just I'd be happy to.
It's an amazing conversation, and you're an amazing person to talk to, just from what you've seen and what you've been able to do and just the things that you've run across in your life.
Yeah.
So thanks again.
I run across a lot, that's true, and my life is much longer than the posted, what now, 77 years, as I'll be like, I've been around quite a bit longer than that in other projects. And, that's a long story in itself. We might go into sometime.
Okay, well, thanks again for your time, and have a great day.
Thank you, Jim.
Okay, bye.